Thank you for having me. So what's happening in India? What's the RSS? And what does Modi represent? Our current, both as our predecessor organization, Inqilabi Communist Sangathan, and now as Radical Socialist, has characterized the RSS as a fascist force. Unlike a lot of people on the Indian left, we have done that with a clear understanding of fascism, not as a term of abuse. The RSS was set up in 1925 in conscious, partial imitation of Italian fascism, with the goal of creating an ultra-right-wing nationalism in India with a deep-rooted Islamophobia. It went on to provide public support to the Kristallnacht and to Hitler's attempt to get rid of all the Jews. Its involvement in the Gandhi murder in 1948 led to a ban, a pledge to stay out of politics, so it had to take a low-profile role for some time. But this only meant penetrating civil society deeply, and it floated a seemingly distinct electoral political face, the Jansangh. The forging of an opportunist left-right anti-Congress alliance, the Congress is bourgeoisie since before independence. So an opportunist left-right alliance against the Congress in the 1970s enabled it to break out of its isolated position, and it never looked back. By the 1980s, its electoral face had undergone a change, re-emerging as a more quote-unquote modernized Bharatiya Janata Party, BJP. Rotten popular frontism by the main left parties, CPI and CPIM, against the then ruling Congress meant the BJP and the left front both ended up propping Vishwanath Pratap Singh's government in 1989-90. From the mid-1980s, meanwhile, Indian big capital was feeling the need to end the state-led protectionism guaranteed but slow growth of capitalism. India was therefore one case where globalization was welcomed with open arms by the local capitalist class, which was poised to break into the realm center of capital accumulation. But while this process was initiated by the Congress, precisely the baggage of history made the Congress a weaker choice at certain levels. It was dependent for its electoral victories on support from peasants, from Dalits, as the oppressed castes are called, from Muslims, from Adivasis, the First Nation or Aborigines. So it repeatedly had to make deals or soft pedal key demands of the ruling class. The BJP, by contrast, emerged from the late 1980s as a party fully confident of articulating an alternative discourse which stressed Hindu religious consolidation, claiming secularism was putting Hindus under threat, openly avowing a free market ideology, and creating a right-wing mass movement from below around the call for building a Ram temple in Ayodhya by destroying a historic mosque. The first success came in 1992, when the mosque was indeed taken down. In 1996, the BJP formed the first short-lived government, and in 1998 to 2004, a full-term one. A popular backlash followed, and the UPA, led by the Congress, was elected. A few major concessions had to be given to the workers and peasants, a very significant one being a guaranteed 100 days of work, especially in rural areas, to one person per family at least. This operated as a state-funded security at however low a level, while privatization and the creation of a precariat were proceeding apace. The crisis that began from 2008 in the West also affected Indian capital. To compete with stronger Western and Chinese capital, Indian big business needed to intensify exploitation of Indian work. Adivasis, who often live in and claim access to areas containing significant mineral deposits and so on. A very long-standing demand going back to the beginnings of globalization in 1990-91 has been the so-called reform of antiquated labor laws, which means get rid of whatever little protection the workers have gained over the last century. Indian big capital was also raring to enter agriculture in a big way, But existing laws, ever since the crisis of the mid-60s, made it impossible for them to go full swing. This was what made the bulk of capitalists turn firmly to the BJP. A so-called anti-corruption campaign was run under the sign of India Against Corruption, using a bunch of right-wing liberal intellectuals with Hindutva connections, a huge media visibility, which targeted only the Congress. One-sided pogroms were presented as riots between Hindus and Muslims, where Muslims were equally responsible. Basically, in 2014, Indian capitalism agreed to give the RSS a free hand with its anti-Muslim, Brahminical, which means oppressor caste, agenda, as long as it carried out its side of the bargain, which it did. It has forced through parliament in recent times labor law changes, agrarian law changes, and gutted the environment. In a nutshell, here's some data. There's going to be expansion of contract labor in place of permanent workers. It becomes easier to increase working hours to 12. In fact, in several provinces, labor codes of that kind have already come in. The Central Labor Code expressly excludes the huge numbers of agricultural workers, domestic workers. Among the domestic workers, the overwhelming majority are women of a worker. At the other end, a wider definition of manager will allow employers to classify workers who are slightly better paid to be seen as managers. The definition of employer now includes contractors and subcontractors, effectively absolving the principal owner and employer so that laws don't have to be implemented by them. A bunch of laws such as Provident Fund, Employees Sickness Insurance Act, maternity benefit laws, which have been guaranteed in the past, are now restricted only to the full-time permanent workers. The rest will only get benefits as decided periodically by the executive. Such schemes will neither be disbursed from legislatively protected funds nor be justiciable out of law. In other words, I am giving you a pittance because of my kindness, and that's it. The farm laws, which have been passed, overturn six decades of struggles. From the 1960s, India had a procurement regime for basic food crop, wheat, rice, etc., at a minimum support price or MSP set by the central government. A public distribution system ensured distribution at a low price to the urban poor as well. Under pressure from pre-free market capitalism, the PDS has been weakened. The Essential Commodity Act amendment, which is one of the three new laws, is one more step towards totally gutting the procurement regime and the PDS. The hoarding of essential commodities such as food grains has become legal, enabling the manipulation of food prices for the benefit of agribusiness. The other two laws aim to eradicate the MSP and to promote contract farming by agribusiness. Section 13 of the Farmers Produce Trade and Commerce Protection and Facilitation Act 2020 says that no suit, prosecution, or other legal proceedings shall lie against government or any officer of the government in respect of anything which is in good faith done under this act. In other words, a bureaucrat simply has to say that I have made this ruling under good faith, and you can't even go to court against it. And if you think that these are all worries about the future, please note the following. The 2014 definition of poverty, it was redefined, but it was way too low. It said that to count as a poor in rural India, your income had to be rupees 32, and in urban India, rupees 47. For an understanding of what that means, rupees 71 is the value currently of one US dollar. But if the rural poor at 260.5 million and the urban poor at 102.5 million. By 2021, thanks to a year of lockdown, The Hindu, a well-known newspaper, reports in mid-March this year that the middle class has probably shrunk by a third and the number of poor risen by 75 million. Meanwhile, This was the picture of the rich. Very quickly, an Oxfam report of 2020 says that the top 1% in India held over 40% of the wealth. They held more than four times the wealth of the bottom 70%. Reliance Industries chairman Mukesh Ambani is now the eighth richest person in the world with a fortune of $83 billion, according to the Hurun Global Rich List 2021. Gautam Adani, who supported Narendra Modi in 2002, when as chief minister of Gujarat, he oversaw the Gujarat pogroms, which set the tone for BJP's mobilization throughout the 21st century. Many in the ruling class were then condemning him, but Adani rallied around him. As a result, Adani has risen from a modest commodity trader to the second richest capitalist in India, with more wealth now than Jack Ma, with a net worth of $56 billion. To end this, let me also mention that Home Minister Amit Shah's son, Jay Shah, filed very modest tax returns in 2014 when his firm had a total income of 7.96 million rupees. In 2019, it was 1,196 million rupees. So capitalists are making vast profits. BJP leaders and their children are willing to dip their feet into the trough. Poverty is also increasing. And this is not becoming adequately explosive because the RSS has been consistently stressing a right-wing nationalist and religious ideology. Caste violence and anti-Muslim violence have become routine with the argument that it's these people who are causing these problems. Muslims marry too many times. Muslims have too many children. There are all these illegal migrant Muslims. Stop them and the problems will be over. In Uttar Pradesh, a province ruled by the BJP, there have been repeated violence on Muslims, allegedly for cow slaughter, as well as on Dalits. In Haryana, another caste-ridden province under BJP rule, in 2019, there was on average four rapes of Dalits a day. Now, there were resistances. There was working class resistance to the Congress, including several general strikes. This was one area where the Hindu chauvinist nationalism of the RSS was able to achieve success. In the nearly 7 years of Modi, there were general strikes, both somewhat spotty affairs. But resistance does continue. The biggest recent resistance has been the farmers' resistance. I'm sure you have read something about it. Farmers are aware that if the farm laws are not repealed, their lives and livelihood are totally at stake. Agribusiness will have the right to dictate terms, set up contracts, reject the contracts in the name of poor quality, sell it at prices that it will determine. Now, peasants keep their own food before selling for the market. Then, even peasants will be at the mercy of agribusiness, to say nothing of the urban poor and the middle class. So for the first time, millions of farmers have mobilized in North India. They're even using traditional instruments such as panchayats, which are often caste-based bodies, which the BJP has used in the past, but which is being turned against it. This is a crack in the BJP's stranglehold in North India. In local government elections in the Punjab, it was swept out. But it has been able to isolate the farmer movement from other movements. A key reason is the politics of the left. Another factor is how the BJP has moved to hollow out the democratic elements in the constitutions and the structures of the state. The latter include the destruction of federalism by using the residual powers to put state-level issues in federal lawmaking processes, the creation of central fiscal power and reducing state shares, the use of the Pakistan bogey to turn the province of Jammu and Kashmir into two union territories, and using this as evidence of a muscular Hindu nationalism, because J&K was the only province with a Muslim majority. The creation of the National Investigation Agency, a body with tremendous powers, overriding the fact that law and order is supposed to be a state subject. Just a few days back, a Trinamool Congress leader in West Bengal with Adivasi roots, the NIA. His wife has accused them of threatening him that he must switch over to the BJP or he will face their wrath. The total subservience of the Election Commission of India to the BJP, including over the issue of election bonds, which enables the wealthy to turn their undeclared, untaxed money through donations 90% of which goes to the BJP. This in place of demands for state funding of elections. The use of various state agencies to silence all critics, politicians, academics, the few courageous media persons who speak out. For the left, let me say that beyond the obvious fact of multiple fractures, there are a few key problems. Indian leftism was dominated entirely by Stalinism and Maoism. So any talk of fighting fascism brings out two responses, sometimes at the same time. One is the theory of social fascism. Forces on the extreme left cheerfully the CPI Marxist as social fascist for the role of the left front government, which ruled West Bengal in 1977 to 2011. On the other hand, when they talk about anti-fascist united fronts, it's rank popular frontism. When they are too weak to be actually in any front, they conduct lesser revivalism of a terrible kind. For example, in West Bengal right now, the far left, a bulk of it, is projecting the right-wing bourgeois Trinamool Congress as a lesser evil compared even to the CPIM. The CPIM, for its part, has embraced the Congress as its election partner. But real struggles had broken out. In 2019, there were massive struggles over the Hindutva call for fresh registration of citizens with the threat to deregister Muslims who are called illegals from Bangladesh. Apart from the fact that few on the left make immigrants' rights a major issue, this was still important. The CAA is the start of a Hindutva version of the right to return. India, by the way, is now a very close partner of Israel, whereby anyone, a Hindu born anywhere, can turn up in India and claim citizenship. The National Register of Citizens will register citizens. In Assam, this was done, and large numbers of people have been put in detention camps. There is tremendous anger, not only among Muslims, of course, but among other categories of people. Transgenders in India, for example, 98% of them have been forced to leave their families to protect their sexuality. So they don't have documents. The NRC will put them into risk. Millions marched all over India from November 2019 to February 2020. One of the reasons why Modi imposed the lockdown with such brutality, if you remember, maybe you don't, there was a four-hour notice between his announcement and the lockdown coming into place. One major reason was to break the mass resistance against the NRC. The left was extremely weak to these struggles. It will be possible to show pictures of left leaders turning up and speaking, but this was a grassroots initiative, and the CPIM in West Bengal, one of the places it is still a huge party, was extremely tardy. They joined 3 months after the initiative had started. During the lockdown, we had mass anger as migrant workers were put in a terrible situation. Once again, in the name of obeying the needs of safety, the left, especially the big left, did not put up real resistance on the ground, satisfying itself with limited relief measures and token meetings. Finally, while left peasant leaders such as Hanan Molla are present in the peasant struggles, the left parties were not to be seen mobilizing across the country, trying to widen the struggle so that farmers' issues are linked to other issues for a wider united front for struggle. So the struggle is in a difficult situation. The anti-CAA movement and now the farmers' movement has put the BJP periodically in the back foot. In the case of the farmers' movement, this is particularly so because police and paramilitary are often recruited from the same social layers as the agitating farmers, making shoot orders or other heavy repression more difficult. But without all India coordination, without the linking of the struggle of workers, peasants, oppressed nationalities and others, overturning this well-entrenched fascist thrust is going to be very difficult. Thank you.
Way to stand. I obviously I cannot rival the long decades of experience and on the ground expertise of Kunal, but I thought what I should do now is give some of my thoughts looking at the situation on India and also a bit of a political explainer as well, some of the background to some of the things that Kunal was talking about, again, from a revolutionary Marxist perspective, but from outside India. Well, I think when the BJP swept to another election victory in mid 2019, there were a kind of a few responses. Well, obviously, the Hindu right in general saw this as a triumphal kind of moment. They felt immediately confident the BJP government to undertake a highly authoritarian and right-wing agenda that involved the cadres of the kind of Hindutva grassroots movements as well. So just to run through a few of those things, in 2019, the BJP government revoked autonomy for Jammu and Kashmir, the special status of those states. It's absorbing them into the centralised Indian state. And this is really a core part of the BJP agenda, because these are Muslim majority regions that need to be, they need to be put in their place, really. And I think this is also about the territorial integrity of the Indian state. They want a strong, centralised Indian state in the coming kind of period of imperialist competition. In December 2019, as Kunal went over, the citizenship laws were amended to basically, put into question the citizenship and therefore rights of many millions of Indians. And obviously that does include Hindus as well, because when you're poor, you may not have the documents that, that certify your birth, etc. But of course, when it comes to questions of the authorities being able to determine who or who isn't a citizen, it's the most oppressed that are going to be attacked for that. So this is heavily fallen on the Muslim population. There's been an increasing crackdown on protesters and the left, both from the security forces, but also in violent counter-demonstrations and basically pogrom-style demonstrations by the Hindu right as well. So that's been the response of the Hindu right. On the other side, we get a lot of, or I kind of following it from afar, a lot of kind of despair from the very erudite, intelligentsia in India, very expressed there is a kind of attitude that night has fallen, and that there is no longer, you can't even really talk about creeping fascism in India anymore. Basically, it's a full-on fascist, fascistization of India. And I think that response, that liberal response, I think we've got to say, is mistaken on a whole bunch of fronts, even though the situation, as Kunal has pointed out, is really quite desperate. Because actually the level of crisis in Indian society and also the resistance to some of these developments has been really, really astonishing. And has shown a kind of capability, even in the worst and most desperate moments, of the mass of Indian oppressed people and the working class to fight back. And that crisis shows absolutely no signs of abating. So I think India isn't just a basket case now of fascist Hindu nationalism and authoritarianism. Actually, really, another India is still possible kind of going forward from here. So just a few points that I wanted to raise to kind of explain a bit more about India, because obviously it's not a nation like our own in a whole series of ways, but India is a modern capitalist nation. And I think that that gets written out of the analysis of India a lot. It has an economy that has been growing through integration with the global market for many years, and more or less on the basis of urban industrial production, just like some of the other powerhouses in the region. And just because there are practices and cultural institutions that predate capitalism, it doesn't mean that capitalism and class politics in particular is secondary for understanding the workings of Indian society. Social class is still the key to understanding the dynamics of Indian society. I think we need to reject here from in the West some of the precepts of post-colonial theory that say that the older institutions, traditions, etc., mean that you can't use Marxism and class politics to understand Indian society. And similarly, just because there is a large agricultural sector with millions engaged in small production, it doesn't mean that India is a rural and feudal society. And that's something that the left has fallen down on at many points in time, insisting that it's a semi-feudal and even semi-colonial society that has a colonial relationship to the West. India, as Kunal really... Those figures are astonishing in terms of the wealth of the Indian capitalist class. India is run by big capital. That's whose interests dominate India and have done since independence. One of the key ideologies that cements the rule of big capital is nationalism. I think nationalism ceased to be progressive in 1947. Pretty much. Even in its secular version, there is nothing to celebrate about this ideology, which attempts to hold together a class-divided society. And in any case, the leaders, the future bourgeois leaders of Indian society, that were also the leaders of the independence movement, were very happy to do a deal with the British to stave off mass rebellion that could potentially shape the society that they felt that they should inherit. And there's always been, to the kind of Indian nationalism, even the most secular kind of versions, a strong kind of Hindu majoritarian undertone, because to seek the desired unity of the Indian state, it is really important, I think. It's been an important part of the culture of the ruling class to mobilise that, even if a bit on the down low, I guess, on a kind of Hindu, on the basis of the Hindu majority. Indian democracy is often celebrated in the West. Like, I know Obama has said a lot of nice things about India being the largest democracy in the world, etc. But I think Indian democracy is really a farce. Who controls India? Not the mass population of workers and the oppressed, but, as I said before, the capitalists and the state managers, etc. The corruption that's often talked about is not nearly the worst of the problem. The corruption is just part of what you have when you have capitalists running the country, basically. A tiny minority decides everything and enriches themselves. That means, therefore, that national development, capitalist development, will not be the answer to poverty. Actually, what does developmentalism look like in India today? In conditions where that requires integration into the global market, exactly the kind of economic and social effects that Kunal went through that have devastated the Indian working class and farmers as well. A few more points. Communal division. Communal division is not an eternal feature of Indian society. Actually, it was a product of the weaponization of division by the colonial elite in order to forge a colony that they could then govern. It was put to good use in post-independence India by the new ruling class to maintain their rule. So communalism, I should explain, is the division kind of between Hindus, politics based around the political division between Hindus and Muslims in particular, but also Sikh communities and others. It doesn't start and end with the BJP and its parent organisation, the RSS. It has definitely been part of the fabric of Indian ruling class strategy and culture as long as independence was achieved. And also, it was the moments of unity in the independence movement, its struggle, and particularly where that was led by the working class, that unity across those divisions was most achieved. And I think we always have to hold on to that as an indication of what's possible in the future. In India, there are many, many different groups. There's a real diversity of oppression and oppressed groups. But still there is a massive, massive working class that is the real main power in Indian society. And the caste system and other forms of division, such as gender, religion, etc., they intersect with class oppression and actually serve to stratify the working class in a way that helps extract more and more profit from them. But I think it's important to understand that the diversity of oppression has been taken on by a capitalist Indian ruling class in order to maintain their grip on an exploitative society. Okay, so all of those things are important to keep in mind. I just wanted to give now my thoughts, I guess, on, and Kunal touched on this, I largely agree with him, on a long-running debate on the relationship between the BJP and Indian fascism, or fascism at all. So my thoughts on that are that the current ruling party, the BJP, is the parliamentary project of the RSS, which is a fascist group, as I think it was formed explicitly on that basis, and it remains to this day a kind of hardcore fascist movement in India, and actually the largest fascist movement currently in the world. And we should be clear about this, because the Indian left when this phenomenon started achieving mainstream prominence, largely wasn't. And as Kunal went through, the BJP in government really rules for Indian capital and for imperialism. And that's been the case ever since they first achieved national government in 1998 and in numerous state governments since and prior. And that is a really important thing to keep in mind. And actually, it's part of the way that they were able to achieve prominence was, on the one hand, by fertile ground for Hindu nationalism being created by the weaponization that I talked about before of communal division by the traditional party of the Indian bourgeoisie Congress, which is the party of the Indian independence movement as well. They mobilised social and political division in the face of rising workers' movement in the 70s and also the resistance mounted by the working class to conditions of deregulation, etc. And then the second aspect of how they've been able to achieve this kind of prominence is by openly, very openly courting and receiving support from Indian capital. To give an indication of this, in 2002, when Modi presided over the pogrom in Gujarat, most capitalists at that point in time, you know, did the kind of the kosher thing, I guess, and you know, distanced themselves from that violence in order to make themselves look like they wouldn't stand for that kind of instability and violence. The exception was Adani. We know the name Adani very well here in Australia because he has begun construction of a giant coal mine in the Galilee Basin. And that is, I don't know, it's not even the worst of his crimes in some ways. Mm-hmm. His list of crimes is extensive, and I think this is one of them. And that's because, actually, even if the statements of the capitalists, you know, wanted to distance themselves from some of that violence, they very, very much supported the policies, the economic policies of Modi in Gujarat that developed that state and allowed them to profit. Okay, all of that is true. But I don't think that the BJP being the ruling party in the centre means that India is a fascist political system right now at this moment. Even though the BJP is part of a conscious project led by the leaders of the RSS, aka the Indian Fascist Movement, and they are using that to reshape India in a direction that, you know, they see as a step along the road to fascism. And even though there's strong kind of authoritarian developments in India, it's still largely within the framework of the existing institutions of bourgeois democracy in India. And I think that's important because to say that night has fallen it's all too late and there's nothing we can do basically says that a resistance and a defeat for Hindutva is not possible, and that actually there are too many people among the mass of Indian workers and the oppressed Dalits, Adivasis, etc., absorbed into this project for the, you know, the good side of people who want to stand against that to ever defeat that. I think that is not true. I think the mass fascist movement is a serious threat, but the possibilities of resistance are not over. And I think that a political defeat for the BJP government on some of its core policy agendas would be a serious blow to the mass fascist movement that is under the Sankaravar kind of institutions. Okay, so Kunal went through some of the problems of how the left is approaching this challenge in terms of, on the one hand, popular front kind of politics, and also this theory of social fascism. I kind of see it a slightly differently. I think that electoralism is the most damaging kind of politics on the Indian left when it comes to challenging the BJP, and that's for a few reasons. I think it definitely starts with locating power not in the mass of Indian workers and mass struggles going on. It invests power in the halls of the state. And actually, to even get to that point, largely, you know, it's kind of lowest common denominator politics. You just have to ally with whoever you will be, whoever party will get you into government. And really, that means bourgeois parties of various kinds. And I think that is where the kind of popular front kind of politics come in, acting as if sections, local or national sections of Indian capital could play a progressive role in the fight against the BJP, when actually they send massive amounts of donations to the BJP because they recognise their interests lie with them. The BJP rules for capitalism. And actually, the longer the Indian left allies with bourgeois forces that largely agree with the BJP's economic agenda, you know, because they're also elite politicians and support the agenda of Indian capital, the harder it will be to actually mobilise the mass of Indian workers into a fight against the BJP. And you can see that, you know, playing out in West Bengal at the moment, where, you know, you've got caters for the left campaigns. It's not just that they're under threat in terms of their very own survival, but also the politics is so kind of hollow that you've got caters from those left parties actually moving over into to the BJP. And I think it really reflects that when, you know, the kind of hollowing out of left politics, and it's occurred internationally as well, it's not merely an Indian development, has led to kind of a politics of kind of patronage. That's particularly the case in India, I think, and in a whole bunch of, not developing nations, but nations that formerly considered part of the third world, which is that it is really about survival and not just physical survival, but economic prospects or whatever. You kind of ally yourself with whoever seems like is going to win. And that's really like a lot of how politics works, particularly on a state level in India. And, you know, when the BJP has a strong ideological core, a mass movement, it's seeking cultural hegemony, it has a lot of money, you need something to hit against that at a social level. You can't just do that at the level of electoral politics. You know, you need to forge a kind of alternate kind of solidarity that's not based on Hindu identity. And that's not going to happen at the level of jockeying for position within the state. Another kind of problem for people who reject the kind of more electoral approach, they kind of go for more a counter-hegemonic kind of approach, which is essentially propagandistic and cannot rival the institutions and ideology of the fascist movement, which is, you know, huge, is what I talk about, extremely well-funded and well-organised. And often it relies on those alternate forms of nationalism, so-called alternate forms of nationalism, as an alternative to communal belonging, but reinforce actually the Hindu kind of Hindutva kind of movement by actually pitting support with discredited notions of national development and also kind of you know, clinging on to secularism, which is not a political reality in any meaningful sense. Okay, so what's the alternative then? I've gone on for far too long, but there is mass struggle, and I think that is hugely important. From the farmers' sit-down protest to on the edges of Delhi, farmers coming back time and time again, even though they know that the cost could be to their lives, the explosive resistance by India's most oppressed, the poorest oppressed community is the Muslim community. You know, the heroic mass marches, millions of people, but also the occupation of the Shaheen Bagh led by Muslim women. You know, that was only cleared out after 101 days using that massive mobilisation to enforce the lockdowns. And it really demonstrated the capacity for organisation and a striving towards unity as well, coming through that struggle. And that's the kind of thing that we need to look to. I'm not going to have time to go through the workers' resistance to Modi's agenda, but again, keep in mind that actually in conditions of crisis, the economy was unhealthy before COVID. It's really quite shocking now that recovery was achieved massively at the expense of the Indian working class. The jobless rates are absolutely huge. I think that provides a basis for worker resistance going forward. One real problem is the kind of top-down approach of the trade union bureaucracy led by various Stalinized parties. But there actually is a space for rebuilding a fighting left, I think, in India. As long as the crisis goes on and the mass struggle goes on, there is a space for connecting those struggles and making links, even if it does have to start from a small scale. And actually, conditions, strikes can really take on a political character. Obviously, a process of clarification on the left is essential, though. And I think that left has to clarify its politics on the basis of the working class leading other oppressed layers, being the most powerful force in Indian society, and from below, not just on the basis of institutional links between leaders. I think there's definitely room for optimism despite the desperation of the situation. And it's a country that we should really be looking to going forward for both an example of the horrors of capitalism globally, but also the enormous capacity of the oppressed and the working class to rise up and fight back. I'll leave it there.